is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. Oh, there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Well, someday finally has come, and I think I do understand some things, and I'm going to share them with you. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me. This is the first installment of Age of Treason Radio. What I intend to talk about today are some basics, who I am, what I've been doing, what I hope to do here on this show, and why. So it's going to be a 30-minute monologue. I'm not going to have any guests. I'm not going to have any call-ins. Maybe someday I'll do that, but we'll see. So Age of Treason Radio takes its name from the blog that I've written at for a long time called Age of Treason. And I intend for this program to be basically an extension of that work. Same subject matter and handled in the same way, but of course it's spoken rather than written. So I like that. I have at times had a bit of writer's block and wrote irregularly, and this will help discipline me to produce on a more regular basis. And it also offers some freedom to talk, and you know, it's more conversational than dry and cut and dried like my writing has been in the past. So I'd like to start by talking about the fact, of course, obviously, that I operate under a pseudonym. I adopted the pseudonym when I first started blogging. Tan Stoffel stands for there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. It's an aphorism I liked, a truism that I thought was clever. I read a lot of science fiction as a boy and as a young man, and Robert Heinlein in particular, and Tan Stoffel comes from a novel of his, although I understand that as a boy himself, he got it from society around him. He popularized it, but I don't think he coined it. And I like Robert Heinlein's work, even though he was a bit of a pulp writer, you know, not very highbrow. What he wrote about just appealed to me instinctually. He was basically writing an extrapolation of the America that he knew of in the 30s and 40s when he was young. And if you can imagine, it's sort of like Norman Rockwell in the stars. You know, he wrote about the future. He wrote about man out in space. But the backdrop and the dialogue and all of that was very much white America. And, you know, in a subtle way, not in your face. And later his work changed, of course, and like Rockwell, as he himself experienced the 60s and the 70s and the social changes and the, you know, increase of diversity, and that diversity is supposedly a good thing. Environment. And Tan Stoffel comes from a novel, though, called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, probably about the middle of his career, 1966 it was published. And it refers to this idea that you might see a sign at a bar or someplace that says free lunch, and the reality is that the lunch isn't really free. You don't pay for it, or you don't think you're paying for it, but it's really kind of a trick, because they just charge more for whatever else you are paying for. And it's not a central part of the novel, but it plays a substantial role. The novel itself is a novel about political and economic self-determination and separatism. It's about a moon colony where the people decide that they want to be free of the oppressive regime back on Earth. It is much bigger and much more powerful, and for a while seems like it's going to win. This novel and the expression Tanstoffel is sometimes credited to libertarians and libertarian thinking, and a lot of libertarians like the idea, and in part because there's a section of the book where there's a politician, a moon politician, who's talking about the virtues of well, he's arguing against compulsory taxation, and he's arguing that in light of Tanstoffel, that there is no such thing as a free lunch, that, you know, and you can't have, he was arguing against taxation. So people ask, well, how are you going to pay for your government? And his answer was basically to keep government to a minimum. And he said if the only law he could see justification for is the golden rule, which is, you know, reciprocity, basically treat other people how you want to be treated. And at one point he says in that passage, I'll just read a sentence here to give you an idea of Heinlein's political philosophy, at least as he represented it in this book, is the politician says, there is no worse tyranny than to force a man to pay for what he does not want merely because you think it would be good for him. And I remember as a young man thinking, well, that's pretty clever. I like that. And because I had heard about it associated with libertarianism, I actually I thought of myself as a libertarian for a while and liked libertarian ideas. But, you know, now in retrospect, and reading this passage again, I can think of a worse tyranny. And that is to force a man to pay because it's good for you, not because it's good for him. Or you think it's good for him, but because you think it's good for you that you make him pay. That is real tyranny, and it is probably it's the most absolute form of tyranny. You know, drop the pretense that for his own good, and for own good, for your good. And I think that is the reason I can see that now is because it's a reality for white people today. What I see is that we're constantly guilt-tripped to do exactly that, to pay, and not just in money, but to, in many ways, and this is where Tanstoffel comes into it too, in ways we're not even really conscious of. We're convinced or swindled, somehow browbeaten into paying for and serving the interests of others. And immigration is the most obvious example of that. And you know, when I started getting upset about immigration, I remember that having there being a conflict there with my up until then my libertarian principles about not interfering with other people and not, you know, people being free. And well, that's a whole big topic. I don't want to talk about that today. Libertarianism. And such. Anyway, I operate under a pseudonym, and I don't think that that's all that important. My name isn't important. If I told you what my real name was, you wouldn't recognize it because I'm not famous. I'm just an ordinary fella. I'm a white American. I obey the laws. I pay my taxes. I try to keep well informed about the world around me. In that way, I'm completely unremarkable. I haven't done anything that would even come close to making me famous, really. Although there are several things about me, I think that got some advice for you, some wisdom to share with you. You're probably curious about who I am. I mean, who do I think I am? What are my qualifications? So, you know, what I am is important, even if it's, I don't think it is important that you know my exact name or what my address is or my phone number, so you can give me a call if you want. I don't think that's important. But let me start with who I am heritage-wise. I'm, as I said, a white American. My European extraction is partly German, partly Italian, partly Irish, partly Swedish, and Another big part is English or Scot, and that part is the part I'm least clear about, but although that's the part that has the roots in America longest, and that's why I'm not so clear on whether it's either English or Scottish. The surname could go either way, and I really haven't been able to trace the roots back on that side far enough back to know. I come from a relatively large family. I have several brothers, and as a kid, we often spend time with our cousins, I remember having lots of fun, lots of people in my extended family. And most of my childhood, I lived in the New York City area. It was in the suburbs. You won't detect much of a New York accent, I don't think, in my voice, because I moved away from there when I was young enough, and I was conscious of it when I heard it in other people's voices, and as I moved out into other parts of America and saw how strange it was to have a New York City accent. It didn't fit me, in other words. Although I had one, as soon as I became conscious of it, I ditched it. But I went to school upstate New York and met my wife there at university, got married to her right after school, and then we moved to Southern California, where we lived for more than 20 years. And now I've transplanted my family to Appalachia, and maybe I'll provide some more details in the future about why we moved and the situation there and why we picked where we are. But today that's enough, I think. I'm a family man. I'm married, as I mentioned, and have children. And so that keeps me pretty busy. And I've mentioned before that my wife's father was Jewish. And I mentioned this in a blog post, and it was a hard thing to do. When I realized it was important, I also realized that, and it was important to me, that who's Jewish and who isn't, that I thought, for people who listen to me, follow what I write about, that it would be important to them to know this. So I shared it, and it's uncomfortable to talk about, and I've talked about it quite a bit in that post. I explained how I feel about it. So I'm going to link that in the program page, and you can, if you're interested in that, you can read that. I just, want to be forthcoming and just disclose that right up front. Education-wise, what I studied in school was mathematics and computer science, and I went on and have spent the time since then working as a software developer, as an engineer, software engineer. And I think that's important. It's been, for me, it fits my personality. But the aspects of my personality that fit was my affinity for logic and order, and it's. On to emotional appeals. You can kick and scream all you want, but the computer is not going to be moved by that. You've got to be very precise in the instructions that you give it, and if it screws up, well, it's your fault. You didn't describe it well enough or accurately enough. So, it's has a tendency to make you focus on reality and instead of wishful thinking. And you get into the wishful thinking and the emotional ego parts of things when you deal with the office politics, but most programmers don't do that very well. They try to avoid that kind of stuff. The ones that do the office politics well quickly move into management and start climbing those ladders, but that never really appealed to me. I'm not interested in bossing other people around. But it requires this programming as a profession requires this near autistic ability to focus on a problem and stick to it until it's solved. So, I say near autistic. I have to admit that's the truth. I mean, most people can't do that, and that's why most people can't be programmers. Now, I know I'm not autistic because the other skill that you need is the ability to shift from one problem to another, you know, whereas an autistic person would get stuck on the one problem and just give themselves a sore on their forehead, banging their head against the wall. Programmer, especially if you run into a problem that's very difficult, you move on to another one that can solve that, and come back and revisit the one you can't solve. So anyway, these sorts of things, I think, explain why it is I do what I do, and the way I do it, the way I think of things. And I've never revealed this stuff before because arguably it isn't important. And it's really just because this is a sort of introduction, and I'm sharing with people who I'm sure are curious. My interests beyond my profession are sort of semi-related to my work is pattern recognition, thinking about thinking, in other words, human intelligence, and the history and philosophy of science. And these are the things that I poured my spare time into before I ever started blogging about politics. Now, as a young man, I did read, and I took an interest in politics, but I quickly got frustrated with it when I saw it was basically just a food fight and this red team, blue team stuff that it's degenerated into. Maybe it's always been that way, but I quickly got a sense that it was senseless and stopped paying much attention to it for most of my younger years. But basically, you know, what my profession, my work, even though I wasn't involved in politics and didn't do politics, I do have an inclination to work with ideas and problem solving. And in particular, I think what I'm bringing to this cause that I'm working on now is an understanding and diffusing of the ideas that are harmful to my people right now, as I can see them. And that's part of the purpose of this program, is to discuss these ideas and how to fight them, how to combat them. So I've mentioned already that I am a blogger, a writer. That's what my work has been in this realm since 2005 or so. It was about mid-2005, I remember. And I was I had already started writing emails with friends, and I was looking for, I don't know, a bigger audience or a more permanent record of what I was writing, kind of foolishly. And I remember in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, the media and the blacks being so upset. And even though I didn't have a white consciousness at the time, a racial consciousness, I just was pretty outraged about that. And I started blogging. I went to public with my stuff that I otherwise would have kept to emails with my friends. These are friends that you know, I knew from my childhood, and that's the kind of person I am. I have a handful of very close friends that I've had for a long time, and rather than lots and lots of inconsequential friends. I'm still in contact with these guys, and you know, I've discussed many of the things, my coming of age, and many of the things that I've thought about, I discussed many years ago with these guys, and we worked out while looking at the stars together growing up. Early on, all I was doing was really reacting to political news and the current events, and you know, I saw things through the red, blue, left, right, Republican, Democrat, bifocal lens. You know, it's kind of embarrassing now to go back and look at some of those things that I was writing about and some of the positions I took on them. It's, you know, the holier-than-thou, know-it-all type attitude even that comes through. And I don't like that, but, you know, that's where I came from. And even then I thought I knew it all, and it makes me a humbler man now looking back at that and what I've learned since and how my positions have changed. I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. But you can find that record, basically, of the last 7 years of writing at Age of Treason. The archives go all the way back to those very first posts. And over time, my style has shifted and my emphasis has shifted from just reacting and kind of parroting what other people were saying to a deeper analysis and more of an original criticism of the things that I was reading, trying to figure out things. I mean, I remember when I started being puzzled by why liberals were so contradictory, why they were so intolerant of intolerance and so hateful in their mannerisms about haters. You know, I thought it was hypocrisy, and there is some hypocrisy there, but I think it's you can find it on the left and the right, and the people who consider themselves left politically look at right wingers as kind of hypocrites too. Anyway, what I noticed after a while, though, was that it seemed like they, at least the left, politically, were playing for keeps. They saw their struggles as pretty much existential. This was do or die, and that came through, and that kind of scared me. I wanted to understand why they feel so strong. I mean, it was almost a religious level of or beyond religion. It's existential, as I say. It's, I progressed over time. As I said, started out as a libertarian as a young man, and there were still traces of that left in me by the time I started blogging years later. But by that point, I had pretty much gone back more into the mainstream. Libertarianism was a fringe thing. It's become more popular since then, but 7 years ago, it was fairly fringe, and I wasn't all that attracted. It didn't seem very practical to me. So I had veered more conservative and was following Republican politics to the extent I followed politics at all, and eventually fell in with the neocons because I liked the appeal to patriotic sensibilities that they made. But once I had noticed that they were not going to do anything about immigration, and immigration came to my forebrain as I started to put my kids into school and saw that the schools were full of Mexican kids who couldn't speak English and were in gangs and doing drugs and all the rest of it, I started to have racial awakening, and I started to complain about immigration, and I saw that every time I did, I was faced by these angry brown people that were calling me a racist, a white supremacist. And I realized, well, you know, if anybody's a supremacist here, it's these brown people who think they should be able to break the law and get away with it. And that was the terms I thought of it in. You know, I'm not a racist. They're the racist. Well, over time, I finally realized that race is real, and it's important. And this is a big break from libertarianism, where you know, collectivism is one of the biggest evils in the libertarian's worldview. But I overcame that, and that's sort of a story maybe I can tell more in future episodes about that progression in more detail. But eventually I ended up realizing race is real, and who's my group? My group is white people, white Americans, people like myself, and I became a white nationalist. And that's what I am today. I'm a person who recognizes that all I have is beyond myself is my group, and I need more than myself. I can't get by in this world with just myself. And even if I could rely on, and I can rely on my family and my extended family, that's not enough because I'm up against other groups that have large numbers of people, and they stick together, and they network, and they help each other, and one of the things that they're helping each other to at the moment is the resources and the wealth of my people. So that's where I am today, and the kind of things I'm interested in doing is helping to understand, educate myself, but then discuss with other white people what we should do. What is the nature of our group identity, and our interests? And, it's been a struggle. We are, as a group, told in many, many ways, subtle and very explicit, that to have a racial identity is a no-no. It's bad. It makes us stupid or crazy or evil, all of the above, and that we shouldn't do it, and that we have a responsibility to make a nice, safe civilization or society for everyone to live in, and that's our duty. And meanwhile, of course, the non-white people are free to organize for their very specific group interests, and I think that can't go on. I mean, we have to organize in our own interests, and it's going to cause the people who aren't in our group to kick and scream, and it's going to cause our own people to kick and scream because our own people have been convinced that that what we're doing, any white person who stands up for white group interests is the enemy rather than their friend. And so we get a lot of problems even from white people, and that's maybe unique. That's a problem that us people who are thinking and trying to do what's best for our people, our white people, that we face that other group advocates don't. They might be ignored, but they're not condemned by their own people in general. So what's changed? You know, I think the most major change in my philosophy, my way of looking at the world, is a fairly fundamental one, but it's pretty simple to describe. Previously, earlier in life, I would have said that it was only right to judge people by the ideas in their head rather than who they are. In other words, you know, race doesn't matter, and you should only care about ideology, and that's why white people get wrapped up in this left-right paradigm. But the change is that nowadays I judge people more by who they are rather than the ideas in their head. You know, if there's a white person who's got wacky ideas, I think the ideas are the problem and not the person so much. So maybe more on that another time. You know, I see around us the struggle that we face is against an anti-white regime. I've described it as that. I think that's a pretty non-sensational way of putting it. The regime that is currently in control of government and the media and finance and academia is anti-white. They are in many ways revealing that they harbor animus toward white people, and especially white people that think of themselves as white people and are not constantly apologizing for it. So, and I think that there's a very strong Jewish component to that. In fact, I think that explains why it's anti-white, and that doesn't include Jews. Because saying negative things about Jews, of course, is considered evil in our society. So, you know, the last point I could leave you all with, I think I'm going to wrap up here, and that is to say that, you know, if you're going to serve the interests of people who don't really care about you and who in fact hate you, as we, most white people, currently do, well, I think to myself, why not serve my own kind rather than another? So I understand that most white people don't really care about my interests and in fact hate me, but that's how I feel about that. I'd rather serve them anyway, rather than everybody else. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Come back the next time.